they did. And she asked her the same question, and she said, I don't remember if it was 4 or 5 days ago. And this woman, she looked at her, and it was just this moment of realization as to where she was, reflecting upon a year, year and a half ago. She stood right up, and she wrapped her arms around her, and she pulled her in tight like they were lifelong friends. Over this week, I've shared, even up to last night when we checked into the hotel, where I was headed on this trip, why I wasn't available to students and other things like that. And, oh, you're going to speak. And they know that I speak a lot. But as soon as I told them where I was going to speak, it was almost like they wanted to change the, oh, that's, and then let's talk about something else. That's really sad. And let's talk about something else. And I said, you know, there's a wonderful resource that exists in getting it. And that can be found in an environment where other people have walked that thorny path. And it's a beautiful thing. From the outside in, that's where I live, because my wife is right here. I don't get it. But as a researcher, there are maybe 8 or 10 people in the world that between the ages of 18 and 55 in widowhood that know as much or more than I do, because that's my area of specialization. So I have a foot in the two different places. But yet each of you, as one young widow, and in our conversation aptly put it, are veterans and understanding. And with that veteranness, those hugs, those connections, it's a beautiful thing. During my dissertation, a second wave of interviewing individuals, because they weren't close, I did most of it over Skype-type technology, so I could record it and interact with them as I went through what we call in academia a semi-structured interview, which means I have a recipe that we're going to follow, but it would vary a little bit based on the stories that are being told, but I expect it to go down that pathway with each of them. One woman in particular, she lived down in the Texas area, if I remember correctly, she was telling me about how difficult the last couple of years had been, principally because no one got it. She says, I'm 30-something years old, I go back to work, no one knows what to do with me. And so then most of the time they just don't. I think many of you have probably experienced that. And she says, but it's wonderful because after a really long day where I'm just sick and tired of everybody at work because they don't interact with me, it's just so fake compared to the way it used to be before my husband passed away. I get onto Facebook and I've got friends in Portland, Maine and Portland, Oregon at the same time. They get it. They get it. And she said, it's a wonderful thing that she was able to do. It's that give and take. And that's where I want to spend some time with you as the class is titled today. We'll talk a little bit about what that looks like. Years ago, a story was told to me about a pastor who he had some baby kittens, and one was particularly adventurous and worked its way up into a newer sapling he had planted in his yard, but well outside his reach to be able to get this kitten. And the kitten was up there crying. I think most of us have heard what it's like. It's pretty disheartening to hear that kitten crying. Scared, but would not come back down. And all the coaxing and threatening in the world, this pastor could not get the kitten to come down. And finally, in a moment of lucidity, thought to himself, I've got a car with a trailer hitch. I've got a cable line on this. This is a sapling. It's bendable. I could pull it over just enough for me to reach this kitten, and I can save it, save from himself. And so he very carefully hooked it up, checked what he was doing, those types of things. And then he just very carefully started the car and eased it into drive, letting just that very little bit of acceleration pull it on its own. And it started to successfully just bend slowly, slowly. And he would eyeball it. He thought he was getting right about to that place where it was going to be low enough for him to save this kitten. And then, whoosh, I let go. Sending that cat, as you might expect, out of the tree now and flying off into who knows where. And the pastor, being a very faithful man, quickly went to his knees and said, Dear Father, I commend this kitten into thy hands. Please, please take good care of him. Better care than I did, of course. A few weeks go by, and he's long since forgotten about this kitten. He's in the grocery store, and in a ways off, he sees somebody from his congregation who is a pretty surly individual. He sometimes tries to avoid her because usually there's either a complaint or something that she's going to throw a jab at one of the other members of the congregation, and he has to referee this all the time. He tries to avoid those confrontations just so that it doesn't become ugly there. And he's driving up, driving his cart, and she meets up next to him, and he glances and notices that her shopping cart is full of cat food. And he thinks to himself two things. A, she's surly. B, she's surly against every living creature, and he knows he's seen her screaming at the neighborhood dogs and things like that. She's not a pet person. And so as they're talking, because she wants to bend his ear, he's got to know. He says, "Sister, I see that you've got a lot of cat food in here. What gives? I know you're not a pet person. Everyone knows you're not a pet person." She's like, "Oh, Reverend, you're not going to believe this." She says, "You know my little Lily, right?" And he says, "Yeah, you're one of the sweetest little girls we have in the congregation." She says, "You know she loves animals." "Yes, I have heard the two of you about having pets in the home." And she says, "Well, the other day, for the millionth time, she was bothering me about, can I get a kitten? Can I have a kitten? I will take care of the kitten. You won't have to worry about the kitten." You know, all of the things that our children will commonly do to bargain with us, to really, I don't even know the right bargain. It's way too soft of a word. But you know what it sounds, what it looks like. Coerce. I tell my children I won't negotiate with terrorists. If they start to terrorize, we don't have that conversation anymore. They don't like that, by the way. But yeah, she says, "Fine." You remember in the meeting on Sunday how the pastor was talking about faith and prayer? I said, fine. You go out, you pray to God. You pray with all your might. And if you've got faith of a mustard seed, you pray yourself a kitten. You get that kitten, I will accept that kitten because it comes from the hand of providence. That little girl hearing that is like, there's a chance here. She runs outside. She hits her knees and she looks heavenward and she's like, "Oh dear God, there is something that I want more than anything else in this world, and that is a baby kitten. If you would give it to me, I would love it. I would care for it. I would cherish it." And she looks, here we're back in the grocery store, she looks back at that pastor and she said, "You wouldn't believe it." As she opens her eyes after the amen, she looks up and out of the heavens comes this cat, meow, lands right in the yard, right in front of her. God moves in mysterious ways, ladies, doesn't he? I mean, is it fair for me to say that from a light perspective as we move to some things that aren't always so much so? My children are really in the mode in their middle childhood ages where they're really interested in what's on the radio. And one of the things that they've watched of recent that they really enjoy is some of the music videos. They really like Adele. They really do. And there's a line out of one of the Adele songs. It's meant to be a love song, and it's meant to be about love lost, not particularly in the context where we find ourselves today, but I think it's congruent. I think it's okay to compare the two. And she says, "Sometimes it lasts in love, but sometimes it hurts instead." There's a lot of depth to that. I think on more than one occasion, Janelle has told me to turn Dr. Dunn off when I'm watching a movie or whatever it is and not analyze everything that's going on. But I'll hear things that tell stories better than I can tell stories. I'll learn things through lines because of past experiences that have been shared with me. Well, this is one thing I know that it's true, but it doesn't make the love go away just because it's hurting. Leo Tolstoy, he said, let me share this quote with you, "Only people who are capable of loving strongly can also suffer great sorrow. But this is the same necessity of loving as loving serves to counteract the grief and heals them." I was on one of these Skype-type calls with one of my research participants, and she was pretty surly. She cussed a lot. She was still in a very angry mode, admittedly. So she apologized, and I told her, "It's okay. It really is okay by me. Your candor, you being real about the way that you feel, is only going to make this research better." And as she was just cussing up a storm about how tough times had been and how poorly people had treated sometimes and just how unfair it felt, she stopped. And she looked at me through the screen for a second, and she said, "Ryan, I think everybody should have to hurt like this." And because she could see me, there must have been something in my visage that she recognized. I might have taken it not the way that she meant. She reeled for a second. She says, No. I'm not saying everyone should bury their spouse before they're 85 years old when we all expect this is going to happen. She said, "But everybody should love somebody and be loved by somebody like this so that when it's gone, it hurts that bad." Now, thank goodness for technology, because normally I would have had to have been taking notes and everything. She says, "I don't think I heard something," for another thing that she said for 20 or 30 minutes. The recorder picked all that up. My mind, my heart, they were other places as I thought about this. And like I said, when I don't turn Dr. Dunn off, sometimes when I'm listening to Adele and watching a Disney movie, whatever it is, I hear something and it reflects back to a truth uttered in a moment of pain. everyone should feel this way because everyone should have had the blessing of feeling that much love. That it hurts, according to Tolstoy, it sounds like that it hurts is one of those things manifest that it's going to be able to carry us. Let me draw something for you. I have a model that I used in my, and I promise I won't bore you with stats and things. I swear on my life, it's all to tell a story. Depending on how much research you've done, recent or late, and personality are all going to fit into this, but you know, your child gets diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, whatever else, all of a sudden we become world specialists on that, don't we?
Yeah.
So we do. Our daughter had a stroke 7 months in the womb. I didn't know you could have stroke 7 months in the womb. Usually it's the seventh decade of life that you have a stroke. But Janelle becomes a specialist on hemiparesis and what it means to you lose that size and what's the plasticity of it and is it going to stop her in school and learn. And the problem with that is it's all one of these. Big question mark. We don't know. And some of that is true about healthcare. But there are some researchers out there, and you may have run into them depending on the amount of research you've done on your grief and your experiences. Mike Caserta and his friends are here at the U in Utah, but they've studied what they consider to be a dual process model of grieving. And what that looks like, to not put it in all academic ease, let me say it in English, they have part of the time you're looking back in your grief, and part of the time you're looking forward in your grief. Now, lest you get so sucked into this, because on my committee, some of the members not knowing a whole lot about grief, I only had one widow on my committee, and she never even wanted to talk about it. Her husband had taken his life some 30 years ago, and she still never really addressed it directly with me. It was still that painful, I think, and personal to her, and I don't blame her. I can't for a second. They wondered about this. Because not everybody wants to get married again, Ryan, because that's not what they're talking about. Because of the loss, I yearn, I pine, I miss. Because of the loss, I'm going to not have him, not have her at the wedding. Not have him, not have her through military service, through missions, Disneyland, how we always did things. It's that type of a thing that the looking forward means. Not like I would normally say to you in a common conversation, I am looking forward to Memorial Day break, to have Monday off. So that we're fair on the English there. You follow that with me. Looks most of you are there. But it's interesting in the way that these impacted grief. And of all the measures, from having money to education, whether you're raising children or not, the list is long, the grocery list of things I asked of these women and men. What is it that is impacting you in your grief? When it boiled down to the end, looking back and looking forward were two of the things that impacted how they were grieving the most. So I'll give you some ideas of what that means in just a second, but I've got to talk to you a little bit about grief per se, because I think it's interesting for a lot of people, like when I teach it at the university, when we're talking about the end of life, not everybody has a real great hold for what grief is. But if I asked you, you know, define, explain love, define, explain pain, it's hard to put into words too, so it's fair. So thinking about this, at the center of all is the person who's missing. Whether I'm looking forward or I'm looking back. And in a book called When We Must Say Farewell, Carl Jennings, he's from the Midwest. I think he runs some funeral homes that are back there. He has some great thoughts in here. I'll share a couple of things from him before we leave today. He talks about remembering. He says, when we recall the grieving story that honors one's mate. Now, this is from the outside in. You can already tell from what he's saying. This is like me talking with you about a husband or about a wife, about a partner, right? How many people avoid that conversation with you? Have you noticed that some of your friends and family members aren't the way they used to be because they just don't know what to say? Because why? Why wouldn't they?
They don't want to hurt you.
They don't want to see you cry, do they? Because if a little one cries in our home, I yell at the older kids, make it right now, even though I don't know what happened. I just assume it was probably the one boy in the family that made the girls cry. I yell from the other room to make it right because we need the crying to go away. They don't want to do that to you because it hurts. I don't want to inflict pain on you. I don't want to pinch you. I don't want to step on your toe. But listen to this, what he said. And all of you, I think, will amen to this. When we recall the grieving story that honors one's mate, we are at the same time validating their choice of a mate, their commitment to lifelong love, and the worthiness of the shared sacrifices and challenges that they went through. Now, you're thinking to yourself, well, Ryan, you fill in the room with other people. This is what you need to be. You need to talk to them, not to us. Well, just a minute. Part of the things that I found in my research over the last 5 or 6 years, specifically looking at women who've lost their husbands, in particular between 18 and 55, was I'd ask a question at the end, if time permitted. I said, you know, okay, we're done with all the questions I wanted to, but I have a curiosity for research purposes, but life living, I'd like to ask you. What about your best friend or a sister or whatever? And oftentimes in the stories they've told, they've invoked this person that's super close to them. So what if they called you tonight and their husband didn't make it home from work? Explain to me what you would do, starting right there. What do you think the answers were like? That was answer number two, almost always, almost verbatim. Number one, they would look at what they're about to be up against and they would do the same thing that all of our compatriots who have no idea what to do when you were standing there next to the casket. And it's like, I've talked to you for hours on end and you have nothing that you can say to me, right? They said, I don't know what I would do. I don't know what I would say. And then immediately they flashed to what was meaningful and helpful and useful. And they said, I would drop everything I would do and I would see a need, I would fill a need, I wouldn't ask. Don't you hate it when people, what, can I, is there anything I could do for you? It's like the home teacher, like you have to it as you're leaving the house. And you're in that fog of, have I eaten in 3 days? I have even no idea. And the truth, because can't we ask? As a man in the church, as a man in the West, I don't mean the wild, wild West, but Western culture, asking for help is like, what are you, a wuss? Where's your dress? Like all these dumb things that we say to one another. And yet some of the greatest things have been when for a moment I would say, even just that, I don't have a specific, you don't need to put any tiles on my roof, but say a prayer. Say a prayer for me. Connect with me in that one way. We talk about resilience. You understand resilience? We're beginning to be more intelligent in what we can see as researchers in what we will call community resilience, group resilience, tribe resilience. That there's something in the fabric of connections that allows even you and I in our individual strengths and weaknesses to do well. Can you envision, if you will, this table? And most of us probably have one of these tables in our house where we have a really wobbly leg of two or three. Do you have one of those in your house, a chair? I heard Elder Maxwell one time say, Elder Neil Maxwell in our church, I don't know if everyone here is LDS. Even speaking at BYU, some people aren't, and it's not fair for me to invoke as if everyone gets it. So Elder Maxwell's a leader in the LDS church. He once said, sometimes our lot in life is to be the strong leg on the table while the rest of them are wobbling. Outside this room, you may not have gotten that as often in your recent despair. But inside these rooms, like those two women I introduced to you at the beginning, my piano teacher and her shy compatriot, you get to play that part a lot. You know what's wonderful to me? I've known Kim for a long time. And Kim and I have had a professional relationship before the growth of this social outlet that we're all enjoying came to be. And she just would tell me these marvelous stories about, I would be just checking the paper. Somebody was 40 and their husband passed away. And she would think to herself, that is the worst. I know that's the worst. And she would go to their viewing, things like that. And people would be like, that's like Wedding Crasher. What are you doing? And she would go there and she would put their arms around and say, my name is Kim. And I'll be back. I mean, that's literally, I don't think Arnold Schwarzenegger there, but think warmth and connection there. And what was 6 became 16, became 60, became 600. And I watched the evolution of that because that's how long Kim and I have known one another. And what a magnificent thing. It's based on that principle. Because you know what? Sometimes it's good to be needed. How many of you watched at all Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, Facebook. She lost her husband in 2015. And then she became a very public figure on this very issue. Wonderful things that she said. Brilliant woman. But yet she was brave to just be very visceral and very, she hung she aired her dirty laundry out there for everybody to see in a very public way. And one of the things that she said was wonderful. She says, here I was spending time with Mark Zuckerberg, who's like 15 years younger than me, my boss, the guy who developed Facebook. And she said, I was in a meeting And I was there, and she says, I can't go 2 seconds without thinking about my husband, and I'm blubbering all over myself, whatever else. But I made some contributions, a few comments, whatever I kept to myself, and probably, you know, burnt through half a box of Kleenex just while I was sitting there. On nothing in particular, but everything was overwhelming. You get this. I can see that you get this. And she said something interesting. She said, Mark took me out in the hallway, and he thanked me for my contributions, noting very specific things, not one of these like patronizing, well done, but like with actual meaning to it of, I think it helped so-and-so, and so this other is newer in the business, and I think you gave him a hands up. And she says, that was magnificent. Because in the kindness of many, they've kind of asked me to sit on the bench and take a breather. And in a moment, I felt like I'm useful again. It didn't cause me to forget. It wasn't the purpose of it. In our society, haven't you found this? And maybe you knew this philosophically before, but I play around in this arena a lot because it drives me crazy. In Western culture, we are scared to death of death. And so we don't want anything to do with it. We hide it, and anything that represents it. I mean, you're like, Ryan, there's like 75 movies at the theater right now I could watch that's all about it. I don't mean that. I mean, how many assisted living centers have popped up in the cities where you live in the last 10 years? Grandma and Grandpa used to die in our home with us to see. We put them somewhere else. And there's a lot of dignity, a lot of wonderful things that can happen there, but it's outside the experience of the second and third generation to watch death. Death happens now in front of the doctor and nurses when it used to be exclusively in front of family and friends. And I'll quote, and I'll do it till the cows come home, even though I think some of the male athletes at the university want to take my man card for it. In Steel Magnolias, when Sally Field says, as she talks about taking her daughter off of life support and how all the men, just how they're supposed to be so tough they couldn't do it, she describes that moment as one of the most beautiful things that she had ever experienced. She's not referencing the loss of Shelby. She's talking about this connection that exists among us. How many of you got really sick over the last year? Like got the flu, whatever else. One of those things where you lose like 10 pounds in a week. You had one of those illnesses? Yeah. It was 7. And you know, you put on your favorite pants and you're like, as soon as you can stand upright, but you put on your favorite pants, you're like, not bad. You know what I'm talking about, that dress, whatever. You're like, you know. How long does that last?
That's how you eat again.
I mean, you really have a big drink of water, and you resaturate all of those wrung-out cells. We have this thing called a homeostasis within us, don't we? I mean, really, like a thermostat in a room, it goes a little bit hotter and a little bit colder. If something goes out of the ordinary, immediately too hot, the AC kicks on. Immediately too cold, the heater kicks on, and it keeps it right in here. If I weigh 150 pounds and I lose 7 to 10 pounds sick, I'm going to go back to 150 pounds pretty quickly. A Kleenex. Your face was dry. Now you're crying. I need it to not be that way. That's for me on the outside. Now, there's no problem with cleaning yourself up. I watch people who sing, and they can sing through their tears. I think like David Belt. You remember a few conferences ago of Come Thou Fount or whatever, and I mean, it's like Niagara Falls running down his face, and pictures all over the internet about from this guy. And I can't. Like, my voice just cracks and goes a million different places. And so, you know, there's a thing about cleaning yourself up in that regard. Ugly cry. Well, I'm ugly without cry. Ugly with cry is just a given. But I come to you because I need you to go back to normal. What we find when we research, especially the young widowed population, where they're running in circles where it's not expected that loss was had, could be parents losing their children, is that people are really just circle around you, hug you, kiss you, care for you, bake you something, or can I mow your lawn for about 2 months, max. And then after that, the expectation is, could you get back to normal? For me. No one is that brazen. I mean, maybe some of you could tell some stories like, oh yes, there are, Ryan, that people that do that to me, but we do that with one another. Because like with the flu and whatever else, our expectation is we're going to get back to normal, right? And they want to help you. It's out of love. They want you to, like when you have the flu, to get back to normal. But let me ask you a question. Let me change my diagram just slightly. Let's say you got into an accident on a walk and somebody texting instead of driving clipped you with their car, broke your leg from the knee down, it had to be amputated. I don't know. How much does my lower leg weigh? I really have no idea here. And you're like, Ryan, you're disgusting. Just go with me on this for a second. 20 pounds fair? Okay, I'm going to lose 20 pounds. I'm going to weigh 130. This isn't like my flu, is it though, gang? Am I going to go back up to 150 pounds? I have now what? I don't have the old normal. I have a new normal. And in the outside world looking in, it's unclear to others because we treat grief like a cold. We treat grief like even things like cancer and diabetes. It may be with you for a while, but there's a way to fix it. We medicate. We provide surgery. We provide brace. In Western culture, we fix it. And I'll be darned as I'm preaching to the choir in this room, people don't understand that. But we're avoiding this idea of I'm not going to talk about the loved one because I don't want to make you cry. But Terry Pratchett says, do you know that a man that is not dead while his name is still spoken? I was in the temple the other day, and I was thinking to myself, as we've gotten more kids, and Janelle invoked this as we were trying to have an anniversary of some sort, and pardon me on having this discussion because sometimes I think it may feel indelicate in the current group. I was throwing my grown-up tantrum version of no one will help us. Your parents are gone on a mission. My parents both had their hips replaced. It's like this confluence of no real people. And it's hard to trust people with your kids for long periods of time because my kids are crazy. Loco crazy. They really are. I love them, but they're crazy. I love them when they're asleep. A lot. Yeah. And I was complaining about this. I was complaining about, and she said, we did to ourselves. We had the big family. Make it difficult, those types of things. It's okay. Okay, that's true. I'm thinking about this as I'm in the temple. And a moment of personal reflection while I'm in the temple, I have this card. And if you're unfamiliar with going to the temple, you know that we do work for people who have passed away. Extending an opportunity for them to receive blessings at the temple if they should decide to accept them. We believe in life after death. And I'm sitting there, and a line from my blessing comes to me. And I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, you'll have many great and wonderful spiritual experiences, especially when you're in the temple with your wife. And I thought, a lot of good that's doing for me now, because like dates, temple experiences, oh, it ships in the night. You go, I go, you go. It's like hand the baton, but never together. And I'm sitting there poo-pooing that as like a lot of good. It's patriarch Allred, like he knew what he was talking about. We never get to go to the temple together. And I'm looking down at this sheet. And on there's the name of the person for whom I'm doing the work to extend the potential blessing. But down in the bottom right-hand corner, there's also a name and an address of somebody who prepared that person for receiving that blessing. You know whose name it was? It was Janelle's. Do you remember in a recent conference where they talked about somebody who was spending some time meditating at the gravesite? And they had that thought, that notion that came to them that said, it's all well and good that you're here, but I'm not here. If you want to spend time with me, you can find me in the temple. And that's not the only time that it's been shared. My wife, independent of me, had been studying. We have a stack. We're getting ready to move, and she's getting rid of the enzymes in the house. So that's one last thing that we have to move. And she came and she said, have you ever heard this? And she read a story to me. And I said, that's almost verbatim what I had heard the other day. It's interesting how when you know you're going to stand before a group of individuals, you lay out books, you lay out scripture, things that you're going to prepare, but life tends to teach you lessons. The first time I spoke to a group of widows, the Spirit, that insight that you receive from time to time just speaks to you in your mind's eye, says to me, handle with care. Handle with care. These are my babies. And I told you, I speak with groups all over the world. It was a special, special moment for me because I'd wondered from the outside looking in, like I've told you, how can I make that contribution with a bunch of academic information? If you look, let me change this a little bit. Let's just assume this is the brain. I don't know. I'm going to get much better drawing than this, than a side view of the brain anyway. There is a study that was done some time ago by a man by the name of, I have it written down up here, Steve Robbins. And Steve Robbins, he's kind of an expert on diversity, on groups, on inclusion, those types of things. And he said, we hooked up individuals who volunteered with fMRI leads, which would allow us to see where is the brain lighting up during different interactions on this video game. And it was a video game many of your kids, maybe some of you play it as well, where you can play other people online at the same time and you'd be in different places. And he said, we changed the parameters throughout, and some of the folks got, well, we don't need you anymore, and kind of kicked off the team, if you will. And we were interested to see, what did that exclusion do for them? And he said there were two spots. If this is my forehead, you know, my nose is out here, my eyes are right there. He said there's two spots, is right there and right there. And I won't read the really long, ridiculous names to you of what those are, cingulate cortex, things like that, that lit up. He said they lit up in the environment of exclusion. Like, well, I don't know brain mapping. What does that mean to me? He says those are exactly the same places that line up when you feel pain. So my not talking to you in your husband's name to avoid your pain excludes you. My Uncle Mark, when he buried my Aunt Debbie, they were in rocking chairs together. He went down into the basement. He came back up. They're in their 50s. She was gone, lifeless, pulseless, breathless, gone. Just no expectation, no preparation, whatever. He'd been working at the IRS for decades. He went back to work. He said that theretofore chums of several decades of work together had nothing to say to him. They didn't know what to say. And you can't blame them, but we blame them because what a ridiculous thing to do. They didn't know they were doing this. They wanted to avoid hurting him, and in the very act of excluding him, they were causing him pain, at least as far as the brain is concerned. Dr. Robbins says, you know, the nursery rhyme, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names, he says, not true. Patently untrue. As a matter of fact, meanness in its variations can cause that. Now, we're talking about individuals not being mean per se. But in the same time, if I fill a room full of couples and I'm doing marriage and healthy relationship education, which I do throughout the communities a lot, one of the common conversations I have to have with that group is not necessarily where we were thinking, well, you could do my roof and you could come and wash my dishes for me, things that you might have needed, but how would you have known? That fog, what is that fog? Like Cheryl even called it the fog. And a million viewers and followers on Facebook said, amen, sister, because you know this, I don't even know what I need. Why would you ask me that? But sometimes it is a necessity. My spouse isn't fulfilling my needs. And one of the first things I will suggest to an individual in that set of circumstances is, in that partnership's not working out for you, have you ever said something about what you need? Like, Ryan, I'm not asking them to mow the lawn. I wouldn't tell you to, but I like this. I think of all the things I've ever heard somebody say just naturally, pray for us. The kids are really having a hard time with this. That's what Cheryl said. So the hardest thing for her is to go home from that vacation and to say, he's gone. And to explain that to a 7 and a 10-year-old. You remember when Randy Pausch gave the last lecture, is what they called it, but he was giving the last lecture really being his because of his pancreatic cancer. He said, hard stuff, I'm dealing with it, I'm fine. You know, 60 Minutes, whoever had him on camera, they were asking, how are you dealing? He's like, I'm fine with this, except in this home, I'm usually the one that bears up underneath a travesty, and I'm there to, but my family's about to be, you know, pushed off a cliff, and I'm not going to be there to catch them. That, for me, is hard. Ladies, gentlemen, have you had the experience to catch someone else at least a little bit when they had their life pushed off that cliff? What did it do for you? Well, for them, it certainly, if we're trying to fix pain reduction, inclusion, who's included in that interaction? The person who was helped or the person who helps? That's a combination of two people. That's connection. That's pain reduction for both of you. Researcher Brené Brown, have any of you heard Brené speak on TED and things like that? Brené's magnificent. She really is. She talks a lot about the weaknesses that we all have and we never want to talk about. It's like, I don't want to let you know that I've gained a couple pounds. I don't want to let you know that I lost my job. I don't want to let you know that my 401k has lost value. We don't admit things to one another, that my kids got second instead of first place in their Little League baseball. She says, vulnerability is magnificent because it's a place from which creativity is born. And she said, in our culture of fix, what do we do? We said, well, certainly we do this. We want to wipe it away so that you and I and all of us, we look normal. Kleenex is going to hate me by the time I'm finished. I don't have anything against Kleenex. What about allergies? I mean, come on now. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't wipe away the tears, but the reason behind wiping away the tears may become problematic. That's not the only way we deal with pain. What's another way that we can deal with pain? Not you do, how could you deal with pain? You can. Yeah, Mei Lin actually says there, I need to punch somebody until they hurt like I hurt right now, right? We can become angry. What else can we do? Yeah. Food and shopping, therapy of all sorts. Like, we have a word of wisdom, but we just go somewhere else with that medication, a drug, ice cream. Yeah. You ever heard the research that says that ice cream sales and homicide, as ice cream sales increase, homicide? And I was thinking to myself, wouldn't it be the opposite? Because, like, there's no ice cream available. Someone's getting the bad end of this deal. Like, especially if they're in front of me in their basket have the Ben and Jerry's I wanted. That would be a problem for them. But ice cream, and they don't have anything to do with each other, do they? But when do we buy more ice cream? In the summer. It's hot. We're outside. Fargo, North Dakota. There is not a single solitary homicide in Fargo, North Dakota in the middle of the winter. I don't care how bad I hate my neighbor. I will get you in the spring. I will wait. So, Ryan, where are you wandering on this? I tell my students all the time, my ADHD, all you have to do is whistle, I'll come back in the yard. And that's where I'm headed with this. We medicate with ice cream, with medication, those types of things. Brené Brown, she says, we've got to be careful. Let me get the quote verbatim. She says, you want to be careful about medicating because, for instance, if I have a headache, let's just make it really simple today. If I have a headache and I want to make my headache go away, I can ask one of you for a Tylenol. And you don't need to be a neurologist to answer this question. I think all of us will understand it a little bit. When I swallow that and it dissolves in my stomach, does it go right to my brain? I mean, like a heat-seeking missile goes to my pain. And when it dissolves in my stomach, what does it do? It goes everywhere. You cannot indiscriminately numb your pain. You numb everything that feels. Take that in for just a second. All that feels. It's a couple of different talks, and then the book, I think, is The Power of Vulnerability. But if you Brené Brown TED, you'll have two, B-R-E-N-E, like Renee with a B, Brené Brown. Yeah, she really is. She's a little crass. You'll hear a cuss word thrown every now and then, but she sometimes just, I think she wants to grab people by the shirt and say, you know, hear me, what I've got to say with this. She's magnificent. But she says that. We can't selectively numb emotion, she said. She says, numb the dark and you will numb the light. Now, Ryan, are you standing up in front of us? No, wrong kind of doctor, that you don't ever use medication. There are magnificent uses for medication. There are wonderful uses for Kleenex. But the purpose, if the purpose is just to make it go away, what is the it? Who is in the middle of this circle? You know, years ago, there was research that was done, and it asked the question, it says, I don't know we've treated this well. We have the medical model, and we have the developmental model. The medical model says pain, we get rid of it. We've talked about that today. The developmental model is everyone's going to die at some time. It may be a wrong timing issue and those types of things, but even when Grandpa passes away at 90-some, my mother sobbed a lot last year when her father passed away in his 90s, and he'd been sick for quite some time. It doesn't make her not miss him, even though developmentally it's appropriate. But that researcher some 40 years ago made a point that has stuck with me for a very long time because I thought, wow. I said, I don't think that those models, either of them, is right on an island by itself. Certainly there is pain that we want to support and sustain. Certainly there is a developmental normalcy in here. You understand that this is expected and normal. It makes you not such an outcast like Uncle Mark at his office where no one would talk to him. Easiest thing he ever did, Ryan, retire at 55. I had to get out of there. Says it was just oppressive. It was oppressive beyond anything else. No one willing to talk to me, avoiding so much pain. He wasn't saying these words, but he was saying these words. It hurt to go to work every single day. And the model, what they said was, somewhere in the middle, could I use a metaphor and be so bold as to say it's a lot like childbirth? It's like, that sounds really weird. But think about it. There's a lot of pain in the process of childbirth. And that pain associated with separation of two individuals. And the pain has meaning. In fact, we've gone so far in the world outside of this discussion of death and loss, looking at childbirth on an island by itself, that women are closer to their children than men precisely because they suffered the pain that they went through. And as you ask that question, I'm saying that generally, not individually, because we all know folks where it would be flip-flop in their experiences, but as a general conversation, we want to look at that and we want to say, everyone should love this much. Because when we hurt this much, just like Leo Tolstoy told us, right? That is the thing. It's not going to be vitamins and minerals, not medication. Sorry, Ben and Jerry, I love you, but even not Ben and Jerry or anything else, it's going to be a connection. As I looked at this, I told you where we'd come. And we're getting close to being finished here, but what was the bigger impactor? It was looking back. Looking back influenced the level of grief of participants more than anything else, more than whether they were wealthy versus poor, older versus younger, and within 55 to 18, everyone was considered younger because we research widowhood plus 65. It's expected. Whether they had education or not, jobs and environment in which they live, social support was even less than this. Religiosity was less than this. Looking back influenced grief in two diametrically opposed ways. What does that mean? They were coming and going. Both women who said that they overly thought about, pined about, cried about, wept, curled up in a ball under a blanket, leave me the heck alone, they indicated they had high levels of grief. And it didn't matter if it was 2 weeks. I did have somebody so bold. I told the invitees on the opening letter, let it be at least a couple of months before you participate in this research, and had a handful of young women who just said, it was 7 days ago, and I need to talk to somebody about it. This is a way to do it. And then I asked the IRB at the university if it was okay to use something I hadn't bargained for, and they said, well, the women are volunteering it, so go ahead. But they indicated that increased, that looking back increased their level of grief. But at the same time, a connection to that partner, if you're looking at social theory, Eric Erickson, he's an understudy of Freud, a lot less sex, a lot more relationship discussion in this guy's way of doing things. Erickson says there's a stage that we should be going through, and if you're a widow, you were in that stage because it's about a relationship. How strong your level of intimacy development was balanced in your life decreased your level of grief. Now, you're like, how do I even follow that, Ryan? So looking back both increases and decreases my grief? It does, based on a connection to that individual. So back to the person who won't talk to you about Steve, Brad, because they don't want to see you cry. The very thing they're trying to avoid, to not hurt you, is actually one of the things that's creating in you the most pain. All right, in passing, as we round this out, a couple of things I want to share with you, some really good stuff. Another researcher to look at that would be worth your while if you haven't found her already in your searchings, her name is Pauline Boss, like the boss at your work. Pauline Boss, P-A-U-L-I-N-E. What about when it's me that wants to fix it, Ryan? I get out people from the outside in, they don't understand me. But sometimes I get to that point, like a young man who met with me in the church foyer, just very impromptu, and my wife has teased me about this all the time. People just like spill their guts to me, and maybe it's why I'm a researcher now, because that works well in my favor when people do. But I've had people come out of the closet to me, no one else knew but me then at that moment. It was the first time I've had. And he came over to me and he said, my wife passed away just a few months ago. We had just moved into this ward. And he got wind of what I was doing in grad school. I was going through the PhD program at the time. And he starts to tell me a little bit about that. And one of the things I'd like to share with you is he said, the grief, the thing that's hard about the grief, this psychosocial, biological, spiritual, emotional response to the loss of a loved one. That's my words, not his. That's grief. He says, it's like influencing my personality, like who I've always been. And it's like I have no control over it. I am an outgoing person. He says, this is the first time I've been to church in like 5 weeks. And every single week I get in my shirt and my tie and I go right over to that door and I grab the doorknob and I look at my two little boys who are desperately wanting to get out of the house. And I say, guys, I can't do it. And they and I cry and go back into the house for very different reasons. They were just little. They were just little. Grief does that to us. And so sometimes we're thinking, I would like to never forget, but I don't want this hampering the who am I. So what if it's me? What if I want to fix this? That's a valid point, and it's the last place I want to take us. Let me read a long-ish quote from her, and I can share with you where the book comes from, but maybe just the quote itself would be useful in the long run. Pauline Boss says, "We may desire closure to stop the pain and suffering after loss, but such finality is unrealistic. Instead, we learn to live with the grief." We learn to have a new normal, right? That goal is within reach. There is an easier way to deal with grief. We don't have to get over it. We can be easier on ourselves because we don't need an ending. Grief comes and goes with wider intervals between feelings of sadness as time goes on. By knowing that this open door is normal, one can, without guilt or stress, experience sadness or sorrow. Now and then, perhaps even decades later, on an anniversary date or when something reminds you of the deceased or lost person. Acknowledging sadness and normalizing grief as something that needs no closure allows us, paradoxically, again, two things going against each other at the same time, to be more at ease with loss. We can live more comfortably with grief when we ignore the social pressure to find closure and, quote-unquote, get over it. Rather than finding closure, the goal is to find the resiliency to live with loss. I believe it is our rush to deny death and the suffering of loss that makes us cling to the idea of closure. Why do we do this? Currently, there is an emphasis on psychological happiness, the opposite of sadness. Can you ever be happy again? When you're at odds with you, go back before your loss and when you were a kid and you took a candy bar or told a white lie or whatever it is, the way that you felt when you were at odds with the real you. It's always a place of pain and discomfort. If normal is living with loss and the fix is to try to pretend, to cover over, to medicate, to mask, to hide that loss, that is, again, it's diametrically opposed to you. You don't go back to the 150 when you've had that separation. I think sometimes mom would like to pull the babies back into the womb because that's the safest and the easiest place it is to carry them. But the separation is ultimately there and where we're going. It's working with that, that we not only strengthen our bonds, not only do we decrease the something that maybe makes us not like ourselves in that personality, like Mark shared with me right outside the chapel in the foyer. Thanks, sweetheart. It's one of those things that, yeah, it makes it better for us. So I'm parting. What do I do with this, Ryan? You maybe thought that this entire thing was preaching to the choir. And I told you lots of times I felt like I was preaching to the choir because you're living with loss. Part of this is for that, but the majority of this is like each of you for a moment, like when I asked my widows to consider if somebody else lost a loved one, all of a sudden you relive everything you've gone through and you're like, oh, no, knowing that somebody else is about to go down that pathway. What can I do with that? What can I do? William George Jordan, he was a favorite of Harold Bealey, who was a president of the LDS Church 100 years ago. He said the following. Let me kind of preamble this. When we get to eulogies, when we get to end of life discussions, our little girl goes to school with Officer Ellison. the highway patrolman that just passed away up in Ellsworth. Thank you. And they have the homage, the cross and the flags and all those things up by Smith and Edwards out now for him. She came home from school and she said, his daddy's more special than every other daddy. And Janelle says, well, yes, sweetie, for their family, this is a really big no. He is more important than everybody else. And I think it's fair. That's pretty apt for a 9-year-old to pick up on that, because when you hear somebody talking about the deceased in their eulogies, it's like, whoa. Wow, I told her, I said, you lie like that on the pulpit about me, I will haunt you. William George Jordan, 100 years ago, it's not new to our social media age. And part of me would have thought maybe it's just the bragging rights that we have in that regard. Let me finish with this. Why is it that death makes us suddenly conscious of 100 virtues in a man who seemed commonplace and faulty in life? Then we speak as though an angel had been living in our town for years and we had suddenly discovered him. If he could only have heard these words while living, even 60%, they would have been an inspiration to him when weary, worn, and worried by the problems of living. But now the ears are stilled to all earthly music, and even if they could hear our praise, the words would be but useless messengers of love that came too late. Those who are facing the battle of life, still seeking bravely to do and to be, they need our help, or companionship, or love, all that is best in us. Better is the smallest flower placed in our warm, loving hands than a mountain of roses banked around our coffin. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, there are a few things that I enjoy more. Yes, even against the oddity that the person at the Hyatt thought, where are you going? Oh, let's talk about the weather or something else. I love to be here with you because I recognize the special nature in which you're passing through. Developmentally speaking, yeah, perhaps we're all going to experience loss. But your loss happened in a space, in a place where you didn't. Like being punched in the stomach, you're not ready to flex and defend yourself. Sooner or later, I'm going to get hit, but you could have at least warned me so I could have defended myself. You're surrounded by people. Is grief just about death? My younger brother played football all the way up to the pros. And when he finally got to the pros, he played for a very short period of time with the Kansas City Chiefs, and then they sent him home. For the first time in his life, somebody told him, you're not good enough. He had never heard that before because of how good he was. Do you think he grieved? That was his personality up through his early 20s. He did. What about the men and women in the last few years who got laid off from a job that they've always had? They were out of work for 5 months, 10 months, a year and a half. We all knew somebody. Did they grieve? All around us exists an opportunity for people who are struggling to do and to be. Yes, I wish I could speak to all of the people who are around you that they might handle with care a little bit better you. But sometimes it's our lot in life to be that strong leg on the table. By example, even if necessary, by saying it out loud, can we not press one flower of gratitude, of support, of strength into the hands of others? Because remember, when the giver and the givee come together, that's where the connection is made. I want to end with a testimony. It comes from the Old Testament. I've been thinking about this for a long time. I studied, what does the Scripture say about widows? And I don't need to go into this in depth. I think you've all read it, heard it, Sunday schooled it to death, no matter what your faith base is. The widow of Zarephath, when Elijah comes down off the mountain, he's been in a drought. The Lord tells him, go find her, she'll take good care of you. And he finds her, and I think he sees her in a destitute set of circumstances because he asks her for water first. He doesn't ask her for food. Like, you see this person as emaciated and whatever. He knew what the Lord had said to him. And he says, while you're at that, would you get me a little morsel of bread? What does she say to him? I don't have bread. In fact, I've got just a little bit of wheat and a little bit of oil. I was about to make one last morsel and eat it with my son and die. And I've thought a lot about what comes next because I think, how does he dare? How does he dare to ask that woman to feed me first and then you and your son eat? And then he makes that promise, that grandiose promise, the same kind of promise that President Hinckley did down in Honduras when thousands lost their home in flooding and things like that. One of the first things he did was tell them to pay their tithing. People from the outside looking in said, Mormon church is greedy. Two young missionaries sitting together with a family, impoverished. The older, coming from the United States, says, three or four lessons, we're talking tithing. This family's golden, but if we bring this up, they can't rub two pennies together. Why would I bring this up? The younger one, having grown up in a third world country, says, I know it's three or four lessons away. He's the first to open his mouth as they walk away from that home. So I can't wait. Could we do tithing next? They need the gift of what that sacrifice brings. Brothers and sisters, when did the widow Zarephath receive a connection to another? When did she receive her gifts? In her moments of greatest duress. Am I asking you to put it away, put it on the shelf? No, I'm not, certainly not telling you to medicate it. But as you connect, as you invite, as you serve, as you love, as you press a flower in the warm palm of somebody else trying to struggle with whatever their grief may look like, I testify to you in understanding who brings all of these truths together, where I find it under a microscope, or in the first book of Kings in the Old Testament. Truth is truth. And I say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.